This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. We have featured excerpts from Conversations in Healthcare podcasts several times on our show, and today we have a discussion about the pandemic that looks at what may be best practices for dealing with a virus that is not yet under control. Hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter talk with engineer, data analyst, and Silicon Valley entrepreneur Tomas Pueyo, whose recent collection of articles in the online publication Medium outline what must be done to contain COVID-19 and minimize the harm to health and economies. Pueyo analyzes actions taken by countries and their impact on outcomes.
Tomas, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
Tomas, engineer, data analyst, and a self-described storyteller. You saw a lot of disparate information emerging around COVID-19, and you realized there was no one cohesive source of information, maybe no one cohesive story, if you will. And you took really a deep dive into the global data around COVID-19, including each country's different approach. And you wrote the first piece, I think, early in March, Coronavirus, Why You Must Act Now. And much of what you predicted and laid out has happened. And I'm wondering what actions should have been taken in those early days to get ahead of the pandemic.
Yeah, and since so much time has passed, I think it's important to go back to the mindset that the world had at around that time. And if we remember, so March 10th, at that point, China was already close to being out, like Hubei. The cases, daily cases in Hubei had been going down substantially. And at that point, it was South Korea, Iran, and Italy that were exploding. Mm-hmm. Each one of them had thousands of cases, and nearly all other countries just had a few dozen. So that's where the world was. And what people thought was, well, you know, I only have a few dozen cases. This doesn't matter. And it's close to the flu anyways. And so that was the mindset of most people. The problem was, if you see something happening in China and then the exact same thing happens in three other countries a few weeks later, and then you look everywhere else around the world and you see the same beginning in every country as you saw in countries like Italy, then you can just predict what's going to happen very easily. And you just need to look at the right place. And so I think on March 10th, Italy had already locked down. So it's not like it was only a Chinese thing. Italy had already locked down, and you could see all these other countries going through the exact same thing. And so the conclusion of the article was just, look, the exact same thing is happening over and over and again. Just do the same things. Mm-hmm. It took Spain and France, for example, nearly one more week to make decisions. It took the UK, I think, two or three more weeks to do that.
Yeah.
And then in case of the U.S., it's just at the state level. It never happened at the federal level. Right. And so I think that's where the mistake happens. And the history repeats itself. Mm-hmm. And assuming that is not going to happen to you is a mistake.
So, Tomas, we are watching the predictions that you made play out in real time in our nation's hospitals in particular and in our cities and increasingly rural areas, which are being overwhelmed. Your follow-up article, The Hammer and the Dance, explores what has to be done now that we are living in the midst of a pandemic. And you note that the hammer, the strict shutdown of schools, businesses, most of society, has bought us time. Still, people are dead, millions are sick, the toll is still rising. Talk with us about why this hammer phase is a harsh but a really necessary approach right now before we can begin to really be thinking of reopening the economy.
Yeah. So you see a country like South Korea, like they had an outbreak, but they knew exactly what they needed to do because they had something similar happen to them 5 years ago with MERS.
Right.
They had the right laws. They had the right public education. And so they didn't even need countrywide lockdowns. They just did what they knew what to do. And the result was very positive. Most of the countries did not have this experience. And so most of the countries were completely overwhelmed. It meant that they had their healthcare system completely overwhelmed. It meant also that they didn't know exactly what to do to control this. And so that's what the hammer is. First, it's realizing that you have a massive outbreak, you need to stop it. And you don't know exactly what are the right measures, so you're going to go very aggressive. And then the second is that buys you time to understand this virus, to understand how to handle it, and to take all the measures that you need to measure to control it. These two big factors, controlling the epidemic and understanding what to do to prepare for the dance, are the reason why you need to be very aggressive for a few weeks early on with a hammer to buy yourself time.
Tomas, a lot of people are really eager to reopen the economy, which you refer to, I think, as the dance part of the equation. And we haven't even hit peak outbreak in many parts of the country, and yet people are marching in the streets for a return to business as usual. And you say there's some clear strategies that would help facilitate opening things up again, and but that we have to be patient if we're to do this without initiating another wave of outbreaks. And I'm wondering, based on your data analytics of countries that have done it right, what must we do here in the United States so that we can all get back to the sort of dance, especially without a viable treatment or vaccine? How do we continue to sort of minimize the risk to human life while preserving the economy as well? Or is that possible?
Yeah. First, on the comment on people going on the streets, there are some people in some places going on the street, and many, many more staying home. And obviously, you don't see them because they're staying home.
Right.
But the tens or hundreds of millions of people who are staying home are the very vast majority. And in fact, I would argue that it makes sense that people are angry because this is very hard. Mm-hmm. So many millions of people have lost their jobs. Some businesses are going to have to close. And so this is a hard position. And in many cases, unfortunately, it was also an avoidable situation if we had taken the right measures at the right time. So it makes sense that people are angry, but it's also true that most people understand what to do. And so the question becomes, what do we do to move forward as fast as possible? And the issue with the measures that you're mentioning that some states want to relax is that you haven't changed anything. So if you have the same situations and you have the same reaction, how do you expect the results to be different? So I am a bit concerned about some of these measure relaxations that happen in different places. And to your point now, what can we do instead? So the way I think to think about it is the hammer is this very blunt force that you apply indiscriminately. A scalpel enables you to be much more precise on exactly what you need to do. And so what is a scalpel here? It is a combination of testing, contact tracing, isolations, and quarantine. What does it mean? First, you need to test everybody or a lot of people. Because if you don't test, you don't know who is infected. If you don't know who is infected, you cannot isolate them to prevent them from being infectious. So that's the first thing. And then you also want to see all the contacts that they've had over the last couple of weeks so that you can isolate them. You put them in a quarantine, you test them to see if they're positive, you isolate them, and if not, you ask them to stay home for a couple of weeks so that even if they are symptomatic, they can't transmit the virus to anybody else. So this is a subset of measures, but it gives you a sense of, if you do this, you can isolate only a few people and enable everybody else to go back to work. But those are not easy things to do. We all know that our testing is not at the right mm-hmm. level. We know mm-hmm. that our contact tracing is basically non-existent. Mm-hmm. So we need to set up these things. The question is not, oh, we've already been in lockdown, are we ready yet? But rather, what measures are we taking, and when are these measures going to be ready for us to dance? I mentioned four. There's a few more. For example, everybody should be wearing masks. Even homemade masks make a huge difference. It is a no-brainer. Just everybody should be doing this. And then there's the obvious things of hygiene, physical distance, and public education. All of these things are pretty cheap to do, and we should be doing them all.
We're going to be in this for a while. What's the best way to go forward based on your analysis to make sure that across the country, our health systems are supported and healthcare workers have what they need to be protected while they carry out their life-saving work?
It's a very difficult one. And thankfully, we're in a place where these people selflessly go and fight these day in, day out, which, by the way, I think is heroic, but also puts in stark contrast with the sacrifices that we ask everybody else to do, and right. and some are not willing to make.
Right.
I think they are dying for all of us, and so we should take that into consideration when we are asked to stay home for a few weeks. But this is a hard situation, and the obvious ones are personal protective equipment. You want them to have their masks and their screens for the face and their gowns, and we just don't have that enough of that still. So that's crazy. So that's the first thing that we need to keep doing. A lot of the production of these things was happening in China. They are price gouging now because there's demand from all the world. So there is homegrown desire to build these things, but then nobody's controlling and coordinating it. And so I have, I know a bunch of, for example, manufacturing plants that say, I can recycle into building face screens, into building masks, but I don't know the designs that I should be using. Mm-hmm. You don't have the money to start doing it. And I know there's demand, but nobody's contacted me. So mm-hmm. how do I do it? So I think that's one of the key roles, is the one of coordination that the federal level should have had, but unfortunately hasn't happened. And so that's one of the keys. I think obviously ventilators, everybody talks about them, ICU beds. I think another one of the keys that we will need over the next few weeks is understanding better the virus and the illness and how they work, because we know that a big chunk of the issue is due to the virus, but another issue is due to the immune response to the virus. Mm-hmm. And for example, ventilators might not be helping for the immune response. And understanding the details there matters a lot. First, obviously, to do the proper treatments, but also then to understand what are the assets that we need to deliver those proper treatments.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking today with Tomas Pueyo, engineer, data analyst, entrepreneur, author, and writer. One of the articles in your coronavirus series, in the piece Out of Many, One, you do an in-depth analysis of why a cohesive public health approach is so much more effective than this piecemeal approach as we're seeing right now. And in that piece, I think you do a great job of laying out some very specific reasons why a unified strategy across the country will not only save lives, but serve the economy as well. I'm wondering if you could illuminate more of your thinking on that.
Yeah, there's many impacts. And I think that is also very linked to polarization, so we need to understand it. The places that are impacted first are always going to be the ones that are most connected to the world, because they are the ones importing the cases. Mm-hmm. And then the ones that have the more density, because then the transmission rate is going to be higher early on. That's because in this country, urban areas tend to be more Democrat, and rural areas tend to vote more Republican. That meant that Democratic areas were impacted first. And then it might be perceived as a more of a party line kind of issue. But the problem is, when you look at historically how these kinds of illnesses spread, then they end up spreading everywhere. And it's not because rural areas come later that they are spared. And so that's, I think, one of the key parts there that needs to be understood is, early on, it was perceived as a partisan issue because of this reason, mm-hmm. but it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And so the response shouldn't either. Mm-hmm. The reason why you need to coordinate first is what you were mentioning, right? You don't want different states to be bidding against each other for these kinds of assets. Mm-hmm. In fact, you want to allocate these assets to the right places, and you want one single buyer so that they have all the force of their purchasing power and the political power. The other one is obviously knowledge, right? Because you have the CDC at the federal level. You don't have CDCs at the state level. So the experience, the epidemiological experience, and the ability to research everything that needs to be done makes sense to centralize that. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I would say is, whenever you have an impact at the economy level, you will have some parts of the economy that are worse hit than others. Mm-hmm. And you want as high a level as possible to go and spread the pain. For example, Florida's economy relies very heavily on tourism. Tourism is very affected by the coronavirus. Right? And so if Florida, as a standalone state, has to make a decision between health and economy, and their economical impact is going to be so much higher than another state, they will have a different conclusion. And that is probably the right conclusion for Florida, which might not be the right conclusion for the rest of the country. And that is why you need a higher level coordination, because you might want to have this federal government saying, you know, Florida, for the good of all the states, you need to shut down, but you are going to incur more costs, so we need to compensate you for that.
We are clearly going to be left with an enormous hit to the economy, to our healthcare system, to our maybe to our just national sense of well-being. And you've talked about we need to get back to a new normal and learning a new way to dance. We're going to have to discover a lot of new dance steps moving forward. But what are they? And how do you envision this rebuilding of the country after the worst of this is behind us?
Here, the term matters a lot. Like there's a very short term, there's a medium term, and there's a long term. Short term is the next few weeks until we learn how to dance. Then it is the medium term is the dance period. And then the long term is once we're out of this. And each one of them has their own challenges. Right now, the short term, the challenge is figuring out which measures we're going to bet on and the ones that are going to be enough. I mentioned a few of them before, very quickly summarizing testing, contact tracing, isolations, quarantines, masks, public hygiene, public education, and physical distancing. There's also probably a couple more that we need. One of them is some travel restrictions, and the other one is limits on social gathering side. Why travel restrictions? If you do an amazing job locally, but then you import cases from abroad, then you have a problem. And this is exactly what happened in Singapore. They're doing a great job locally, and then import cases from workers that worked in dormitories, and then they had an outbreak. So you will probably need to do that. Another thing that we might need to do is also limits on social gatherings, because if you have, for example, a very big fair for that lasts 3-4 days with 5,000 people coming from all of different places of the country, the likelihood that one of these people or a few of these people come and infect all these other networks that are available in that place is very high. And so then you can have a huge super spreader event like this, like the one that happened in South Korea, where just a woman that went to a church twice created 5,000 cases. So these are some of the measures that we will need to take. And then that's the medium term. Like, how do we live with these measures? And the new normal might be now you have a mask on you all the time. Now you cannot shake your hands. Now, if you're in a meeting, you should not have 10 people in a small room, but maybe it's just two or three people and you're sitting in a way that you don't face each other. But if you face each other, you can have droplets of jumping from one mouth to somebody else's face and infecting them, right? So there's a lot of these small things in your day-to-day that are going to change. And so that's on during the dance period. And then there's a question of after that, right? After there's a vaccine, after there are treatments, how we can tackle this. And I think there's a lot of questions that we will need to ask, because we have seen that many of the systems in the United States were not well equipped to respond to these crises. The US is a country that relies very heavily on the market economy, and that is fantastic for many, many things. But the government is just a tool, and it's just a tool for coordination. And so if you face a situation like this one where you need coordination, you need the state to provide the government, in this case, to provide a solution. My wife, for example, was in isolation because she might have had the coronavirus, and she turned out to be negative, but it cost us over $2,000. If it's going to cost us through the current healthcare system $2,000 per person to be tested for the coronavirus, nobody's going to get tested. And if nobody gets tested, nobody will go, we can't control the epidemic. So you need an intervention at the healthcare level to prevent these type of epidemics from happening again. And so this is the type of conversations we're going to have for the long term.
Your latest installment in this lexicon of work that you are doing, entitled The Basic Dance Steps Everyone Can Follow, in addition to adopting these improved population health protocol, you really sort of lay out for the public the role, the important role they could do. Wearing masks, hand hygiene, simple behaviors we are likely to see with us for a long time. Tell us how that public plays perhaps the most vital role as we move through the course of this pandemic.
I think it's important to start where you started, which is what Dr. Fossey said around the fall. And my interpretation of it is not that it has to happen, but rather that based on what he understands and what's happening in the US, it is likely that we will be suffering another one. Many other countries will probably not. So it really depends on us. And we've seen that governments in different levels are taking the right decisions, but not all. And so, as you say, yes, citizens have a role to play. Businesses have a role to play. And so for the blocking and tackling, I think it's important to understand the science that we know today of the virus. And what we thought a few weeks ago is that it was transmitted through droplets. You speak, or like you cough rather, and you emit a few droplets that fall on the ground within 6 feet, within a few seconds. And so you're good as long as you're not coughed in the face. And we've learned since that that's not the case.
Right.
It's not only the coughs within a few meters, but it might be you speaking. It might be you just singing, right? Like a choir in Washington State, 60 people, 45 got sick. In the church, the mega church in South Korea, these people are singing a lot still, right? So singing is a way to do it. And we also know now that you can emit, when you cough, for example, a cloud of droplets that stays in the air for longer and goes farther away from a couple of meters. One of a fascinating study analyzes something that happened in the Chinese city of Guangzhou, around three families sitting in three different tables at a restaurant,
right.
And just one person in one of the tables ended up spreading the virus to seven or eight people in three different tables. Mm-hmm. Many of them were farther away than 6 feet. And so that tells you some of the patterns of the spread, which is it happens exceptionally when there's a lot of talking, singing, contact, close to each other in confined environments for a long period of time. This is what you need to avoid. And the things that don't look like they are infecting too much are, for example, walking outside. Mm-hmm. So once you understand that, you start understanding some of the things that you can do to prevent this from happening. For example, why are masks so important? Because half of the transmissions are asymptomatic, are pre-symptomatic, which means that people don't have symptoms yet, but they're sick, and they're already transmitting the virus. If you have a mask, all these droplets are going to stay in the mask. And since we don't know who is sick and who isn't, everybody should be wearing these masks. Mm-hmm. First, because it prevents others from being infected. Mm-hmm. But also, obviously, because it protects you from being infected too. But especially because it prevents people from infecting others. Mm-hmm. Then you also understand that if this is what's happening, then you shouldn't be sitting in a meeting, five people in the same room, talking for an hour. Because that's a recipe for disaster. Right. So now you start understanding what are some of these measures that you can take.
Tomas, we want to thank you for sharing your really remarkable skill for clear communication and taking complex data, turning it into digestible stories.
Thank you so much for having me. I think what you're doing is extremely important. Spreading this message is the single most important thing and the most impactful thing we can do for the health and the economy of this country.
That was an excerpt from Conversations on Healthcare with hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter in a discussion with Tomas Pueyo about his research into ways to deal with the pandemic. You can hear more at chcradio.com. Coming up on Main Street, the manager of North Dakota's Census Office will talk about the importance of the once-a-decade headcount and how it's progressing. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Two more individuals have passed away with COVID-19 in North Dakota, bringing the statewide coronavirus pandemic death toll to 56. The patients were both women from Cass County with underlying health conditions. One was in her 90s, the other was in her 70s. Additionally, 17 new cases of the novel coronavirus have been confirmed by the State Health Department. The cases were from a pool of 1,048 tests for a daily positive rate of 1.6%. 16 of the new cases were from Cass County. Grand Forks County had one new case. There have been 2,439 total positive cases overall. There have been 1,762 recoveries. This leaves 621 total active confirmed cases. The Public Service Commission will hold an informal hearing with the three investor-owned utilities that serve North Dakota to see what effects the COVID-19 pandemic have had on their incomes and expenditures. The three are Montana Dakota Utilities, Xcel Energy, and Otter Tail.
Utilities are experiencing unanticipated costs due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but they could range from an increase in bad debt, uncollectible amounts that individuals or businesses may owe as a result of the pandemic, although companies are working with individuals to determine payment plans that might be better suited for their current situation.
Krasha says there may also be added costs for employees working from home. He says the informal hearing would look at ways the utilities could recover some of those costs. And officials with the Red River Valley COVID-19 Task Force say the increasing number of test results coming back positive for Cass County stems from an increasing level of testing and contact tracing. Desi Fleming is with Fargo-Cass Public Health and is co-chair of the task force. She says the county is doing a lot of things right when it comes to target testing and preventing the spread of the virus. She says a focused effort is being made not only to do testing for individuals, but to do contact tracing to locate others that may be positive after encountering a person with an active case.
Contact tracing involves, through phone interviews, identifying close contacts that have been exposed to a positive case. Each case gives, on average, five contacts.
Fleming says there is a large group in the Fargo-Moorhead area helping with the contact tracing. She says the group is currently following 595 active cases and 1,200 contacts. Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney says the rate for positive testing in the county is 4 to 5%. He says he has talked about those numbers with the governor. Mahoney says he thinks the results could support a further reopening of business activity.
We feel as the epicenter of the largest city in the state, we may have some numbers because we have a greater mix of population, but feel still that our business should go open up. Restart it needs to be done to get the economy going as well. So it's a balance, but it'll all be transparent.
Officials say as things begin to reopen, it does not necessarily mean things are back to normal. They say they are still encouraging the use of masks when you are in public and are unable to practice safe social distancing. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Kevin Iverson. He is the Census Office Manager for the state, and he works in the North Dakota Department of Commerce. He joins us from his home in Bismarck. You're working in the basement like I am, Kevin.
Yes, I am.
Well, let's talk about the census and the importance to the state. When did the official effort get underway for the 2020 census?
It started the day after the president declared a national emergency. About the 13th of March was the day the first forms arrived at individuals' houses, those individuals that received their mail at their residence.
And what population estimate did you start with, or do you start with one?
The way the census is done is you count the number of housing units, and then you count the number of individuals in each of those housing units. And so it's, first of all, a count of where people live. You try and get a handle on that. But overall, our most recent data is 2019 population estimate, which was about 760,000 individuals in the state of North Dakota.
Do you have a working number for outmigration, for example, changes in employment due to the pandemic?
Well, you know, that's really tough. I really don't, because we don't know how many just became unemployed and how many became left jobs to go elsewhere. At this point, I really don't have a guess for that.
Why is the census every 10 years? It's the 21st century. Why isn't it just ongoing?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, it's very expensive to do the census. You know, in 2010, it cost $42 per person. I'm sure it's going to be quite a bit more this time around. $42 per person, you know, that's money we could use for other things like roads and bridges and schools and hospitals and things like that.
And that's how much it costs the state.
Well, no, that's how much it costs the federal government nationwide. The state this time is spending $1 million for the census effort.
But this is important for the bottom line of the state, isn't it? Every head means something in terms of funding.
Yeah, absolutely. This is huge. And so we use the numbers from the George Washington University Counting for Dollars program. George Washington University has been putting out data for a number of years, actually for the last 4 years, in terms of what the economic impact of the census is to states. And for the 16 largest programs, things like Medicare, Medicaid, school lunch programs, Title I grants, road construction, for the 16 largest programs, it came out to $19,010 per person in 2015. Now, the nice thing about using 2015, it's the middle of the decade. And since that impact occurs every year, we just multiply that figure by 10 to get to $19,100 as an estimate. Now, I believe that's a very conservative estimate, and it only covers those top 16 programs. Subsequent studies that the Counting for Dollars program put out show that there were actually 316 federal programs in which census data is used for. However, calculating the impact per state is kind of like reading spaghetti code. After a while, every program uses it differently. It's pretty hard to track exactly what the economic impact is at the state.
So you're talking about counting people within housing units. There are homeless people. There are people who, for other reasons, may not have a specific residency. Are there other ways to determine what is an official resident of North Dakota?
The rules that the Census Bureau uses is a little bit different than legal residents. For instance, service members who are assigned at Minot Air Force Base may be a legal resident of Michigan, or they may vote or have license plates on their car that say the state of Michigan or Wyoming or whatever. However, they're counted as North Dakota residents because that's where they're spending the majority of their time. The census counts you where you spend the majority of your time. The United States has a little bit of different approach and has had since the original census in 1790 of how we count individuals. We count individuals where they're at, regardless of their citizenship. For over 200 years, we've counted family of diplomatic staff as residents. So it's important for us because we have a large military population and they're spending the majority of their time in North Dakota. It's important that we count that population. It's also very important that we count students at our major universities because many of them are legal residents outside the state or maybe foreign, but they're spending the majority of their time here. And so those numbers are used in the federal formulas to calculate the distribution of funds. So we want all those individuals counted in North Dakota.
Well, there are other populations, too, that might be a little more difficult to count. I know that there was a dispute over residency or addresses for Native Americans, for example, for voting. How do you count those people on reservations, and do you rely on help from tribal governments for that? And for that matter, how do you count people who might be Hispanic and might be concerned about their legal residency or the legality of somebody in the household?
One of the things that happens with the census data, it is not used for any other purposes. The Census Bureau will not share the data with any other federal agency or the state or anybody else. And even working with the address data, which we were able to do this year, we had to take an oath of secrecy, and the penalties for violating that is 5 years or $250,000 fine. And when you take the oath, you take that oath for life. That means if at 85 I were to discuss information that I saw, I would be potentially subject to prosecution for violating that Title 13 oath that I took. They're very strict in terms of the confidentiality rules, and they don't share that data for any other purpose. The question of citizenship is not in the census. It was proposed. That got shot down in court, but is not one of the questions that's asked on the questionnaire.
Kevin Iverson is the North Dakota Census Office Manager for the State Department of Commerce. Kevin, are you where you hope to be at this time in the count?
Well, we're not quite where we'd hope to be. Certainly, you know, we had a concern with a number of populations in the state, Bakken oilfield workers, rural counties, and American Indian populations. And when we look at those counties that have high American Indian populations, we've been doing less than great. And part of it has to do with the delay in what's called the update leave program. As I mentioned earlier, individuals who received their mail at the residence began to receive those forms in March. What was supposed to happen just shortly after that was a program called Update Leave, and that's where census enumerators were supposed to go door-to-door and drop off forms to those households that received their mail by post office box. And the reason the Census Bureau was doing that is they cannot directly tie a post office box to a residence. And so we did a lot of work with the Bureau, making sure that they had a very thorough understanding of our residential data in North Dakota. But the program to deliver those forms was delayed and just started the last couple of weeks. Now, a couple of the American Indian reservations, I believe it's Spirit Lake and three affiliated tribes, had not opened yet, at least as of last week. So the others have been opened and forms are now being delivered. But where we see those high American Indian populations, we have a very low response rate. Right now, for instance, in Sioux County, the estimated response rate is only 14%. But also in the oil field areas, we've done less than spectacular. McKenzie County shows at 27.5%. So that means almost 3 out of 4 households have not responded to the census. And I suspect that is not just oil field workers. I suspect a lot of that has also to do with very rural populations in the state historically have had a tendency to respond at a much lower rate than urban populations. And that is showing up today. You know, if you go look at Burley County, for instance, Burley County, as of yesterday, 74.4%. That means 3 out of 4 households have responded, which is great. But when we go out to Divide County, certainly off the beaten path, it's only 1/3 of the households have responded to the census. And so where you're at seems to make a huge difference in terms of your response, your probability to respond to the census.
What is the deadline for completing the count? I mean, the tax returns have been pushed a couple of months because of the concern about the pandemic. Is there a change for the census count?
There is. Now, originally, they were planning on sending individuals into the field in June. That has been pushed back into August and will actually run from August into October. And so individuals have not completed the census will eventually be contacted by enumerator knocking on their door seeking to collect that information. Just because you don't respond to the census doesn't mean you get out of the census. You're still counted one way or another. They will do everything they can to count individuals.
So you will still be going door to door to those people who haven't gone online, for example, as was possible.
Right now, that is the plan, yes. And pretty much everything has been moved back in terms of the timeline. So the non-response follow-up runs into October, and previously where individuals had until the end of July to self-respond. And by the way, many people begin to self-respond to the census when they find out an enumerator will come door-to-door. And so we expect that historically, that's been about 13% of the responses have come in after people find out somebody's going around the neighborhood and collecting data because they would really rather just respond themselves. That date has been pushed back to the end of October right now. Also, originally, all the information was supposed to be packaged and sent to the president the end of the year by December 31st of this year. It has now been pushed back to March 31st of 2021. The state was supposed to get the data by April 1st of next year. That will be pushed back until July 1st of 2021. So we will not see the data in terms of the census count until the middle of this next year.
You mentioned that urban areas, cities, were more likely to respond to the mail-in request for online registration. I did that weeks, months ago, I think. Why do you think some people do not respond to that? Is there some doubting about what the federal government's up to? What would be the reason for that?
My suspicions are that that it has to do with people don't understand the impact that the census has and the federal government has on their lives. Many times in rural areas, people are just more isolated and don't understand that proportionally it has just as much impact on them and the road that they're driving on back and forth to a store a stockyard or something like that than it does to anybody in an urban area. That same data is used. The same proportion of funding generally follows them. We historically have just had a lower response rate in those more rural areas. And we call them the frontier counties. Those counties with less than 6 persons per square mile tend to be our lowest responders. Montreal County, for instance, in 2010, only 50% of the household self-responded to the census. The other half ended up with people knocking on the door seeking their information.
Well, considering the benefits behind every head counted and the importance to state governments, does the federal government audit states? I mean, there would be a huge incentive to pad the numbers, wouldn't there?
All of the actual work is done by the federal government. The state's involvement is certainly in using the data that comes out of the census, but also promoting the census locally. And that's because we certainly have a stake in the outcome of how it's done. However, the actual work, the hiring of enumerators, the assignment of individuals, and the actual processing of the data all happens internally within the Census Bureau. We don't actually get to choose that. And you're right. I think there would be a real incentive to cheat if states had that ability.
Kevin Iverson is the North Dakota Census Office Manager. Kevin, I went up online. It's easy to find information about the North Dakota Census. It's just Google it and you'll get there. And I discovered that you were looking for enumerators. Are you still looking for people to do that? And what's the compensation?
Yeah, the local office was hiring enumerators. In most counties of the state, in most of the western counties, they were paying $21 an hour. In the eastern counties, it was $18.50 an hour. That's not completely east-west. For instance, Cass County is $21 an hour, and there's a couple counties in the west that was $18.50. So they kind of set a flat rate, an hourly rate. And I do know also the Bureau is reimbursing mileage and things like that. They're providing personal protective equipment such as face masks because of Corona.
Do you have enough people to do the job?
In my conversations with the local federal manager, she feels that they're comfortable. They would like a few more people, but they were comfortable. They did not lose a lot of people after we all ended up in home quarantine for a while. So overall, she felt they were fairly comfortable with where they were at.
So have you hired people laid off by the pandemic? I mean, this would seem to be a job opportunity for people who are between work.
Yeah, it seems like a great opportunity for individuals who are between work. You obviously have to be available, a clean driving record, access to a vehicle, and so on. So I think it would be a great opportunity for a temporary position.
Do you have a way to estimate how many you missed? I mean, if you miss them, I guess you don't get the compensation or the funding from the federal government. But is there a way to determine roughly how much the state is missing out?
Not during the census itself, but after the census is completed, the Census Bureau will run a program called demographic analysis, in which they will look at data they collect from other federal agencies, do an estimate of the number of individuals that were missed as a result of that. In 2012, a study came out, estimated the number of children that were missed. And in the study, they showed that in the state of North Dakota, there were 846 households where children were not identified in the census, but were later identified in other forms of federal data. Many times that was income tax data. So an individual forgot to identify their children, or maybe felt it was none of the enumerator's business, or didn't complete the form, or for whatever reason, those children were just not identified in the census. But later that household claimed children in their tax return. Now, that doesn't mean the census is corrected as a result of that. That just means a discrepancy is identified. We know it exists.
So are estimates any part of the reporting process, either by the Census Bureau or some other way?
There are a number of other studies, but it's all internal within the Bureau. They will release the results. We don't actually see for instance, the list of households that were missed. That information is not shared with the state.
What brought you to this job?
This is my second career. I retired from the military in 2005. And I was looking for something different to do, and I found that I really had a kind of a love of business research and statistics. I went to work for Job Service as a labor market analyst, doing data work for them. And I ended up on the census committee in 2008, involved in the census effort. The rest is kind of history from there. So when a full-time job opened with the state, I was asked if I was interested, and I said I'd give it a try. And that's kind of where I'm at today.
Well, as census office manager, is there work with the numbers that lasts after the count? I mean, is this a 10-year job?
There's a tremendous amount of research that continues to go on. People think that the census only happens once every 10 years. But in fact, there are ongoing surveys that are happening all the time. The Census Bureau has about 133 studies going on average. And you think in terms of the American Community Survey, where we have a 1% sample of households annually, that data really provides the how we live. Well, the census gives us the count of the individuals and some of the very basic demographic information. The socioeconomic information comes from the American Community Survey. Another important factor going on is the current population survey. Much of the work there is done to measure the unemployment numbers for the Bureau of Labor Statistics, but many other things are kind of thrown into that. In fact, that provides the annual estimate or official estimate of the poverty rate for each state on an annual basis. But there are many, many things going on an annual basis. Even after the census, each year the population estimate, which we use to a great extent, is updated, and it's updated based on births, deaths, and migration. You know, we try and understand where people are moving from, where they're moving to, what the age ranges are, demographically, how we're changing. Are we, you know, certainly the state of North Dakota has become less non-Hispanic white. You know, if we go back to the 1930s, the state was 96 non-Hispanic white, almost completely made up of individuals of Northern European ancestry. Today, that's down around 85%. Those kinds of changes we're tracking on an ongoing basis to try and understand how the state is changing, how our population is changing, how it's aging. You know, how do we stand in terms of the birth rate or fertility rate compared to other areas of the state? You know, trends that we're seeing, and so on. There's just a lot going on, and there's so many users of this data, whether it's for community development, economic development, the public health sector is using a tremendous amount of data. The university professors, you know, I'm contacted quite often by individuals who are working on their master's degrees or doctoral work, trying to understand or get some basis of where they can get some information. There's just a lot that's actually that this data is used for.
Kevin Iverson is the North Dakota Census Office Manager. Kevin, thank you for spending time with us today.
Yeah, you bet. And thanks for having me on.
Dakota Datebook is next.
On the next Intelligence Squared U.S., a conversation with Vox Media's Ezra Klein.
That depolarized period in mid-20th century America that is often looked back on in our textbooks as a kind of golden age of American politics, it was built on a boneyard.
Polarization. It seems like a bad thing, but compared to what? Join us on the next Intelligence Squared U.S.
Intelligence Squared U.S. This week's Prairie Public Presents comes your way Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 27th. In 1919, farms and communities across the state had been drained of young men called into service during 2 years of war. Weekly casualty list contained the names of local boys who died in the war, eventually totaling 474. And when combined with the Spanish flu epidemic sweeping the state from October to December, death had visited most doorsteps. On this date in 1919, the city of Cooperstown was preparing for Memorial Day. Among those being honored was Sigurd Lima, a 26-year-old Cooperstown blacksmith who only a year earlier had boarded a train to Fort Lewis, Washington after being inducted into the Army. Lima, born in Norway in 1892, had obtained his citizenship only 3 years prior to his induction. Following basic training in 1918, he was assigned to an infantry company and sent overseas. In September, he transferred to the 308th Infantry as a replacement, joining a company engaged with the enemy in the Argonne Forest. His battalion had been ordered to advance further into the dense woods, and in doing so, they were surrounded and cut off. For 5 days, the Lost Battalion, as they became known, fought with almost no food or water and steadily diminishing ammunition. The fighting was fierce, and when they were rescued on October 7th, less than half the 500 men had survived. Carl Michelson from Hannaford, North Dakota, was in the same squad. According to his account, Private Lima had been severely wounded, and two men had carried him from the fighting. But when the war ended, the citizens of Cooperstown and Lima's parents in Norway waited impatiently to learn of his fate. No trace of Lima had been found, and for years the question lingered. It was almost a decade later, in March of 1928, that the War Department announced that Private Sigurd Lima had been killed in action on October 3, 1918, during the Argonne Offensive, and was buried in the Meuse Argonne American Cemetery in France. And it was with that announcement that the last North Dakota soldier in the Great War had been accounted for. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Jim Davis. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming on Prairie Public, know that it's supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
In Alabama, a state hit hard by COVID-19, one man is committed to helping the homeless as they live through a pandemic.
And that means going out at 10 o'clock at night to the worst parts of Montgomery to take someone some supplies that they called up and said they desperately needed. That's what we're going to do.
His efforts to make sure homeless communities are taken care of. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street, and a reminder that as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can always find the show as an archive podcast at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, we'll learn how school counselors work with students during distance learning. Watford City High School counselor Rachel Michael will share her experience with Tom Gerhardt, host of the Education Mindset podcast, and Sue Balcom will join us for Main Street Eats. We hope you can be with us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.